ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Fairlight Computer Music Instrument. Load startup disk.
Hello and welcome to the History Listen. I'm Kirsty Melville. And today, the story of a very special musical instrument. A synthesizer that you've probably never heard of, but one you've definitely listened to, whether you realise it or not. The Fairlight Computer Music Instrument, or CMI, was so revolutionary that it changed how popular music sounded, from its creation back in the 1980s, right through to the present day. Today, James Viver brings us the story of, and the soundtrack to, this remarkable Australian invention.
Load biography disc.
The best way for us to learn about the Fairlight is to use the instrument for what it was designed for, to make music. We're going to produce a song using the Fairlight, telling the story along the way. To get started, we need to go back to 1913. That's Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. So what does a pre-World War I Russian composer have to do with a 1980s synthesizer? Let's listen to the start again. That opening phrase of music, the Fairlight turned into a sample called Ork 2. And you might be thinking, I know that sound from somewhere. You're probably right. That sample has been on a lot of records. Afrika Bambaataa was one of the first. Let's just listen again to make sure that you got that. There's the sample there. Whether played up or down the scale, that sample has been used hundreds and hundreds of times.
Michael Jackson. I never knew when I was walking the line. Madonna. Duran Duran.
Clearly, we'd be in good company if we were to use Ork 2 in our Fairlight song. But before we get too far, let's meet the two old schoolmates who invented the Fairlight.
Look, I was always a Stevie Wonder fan, the moody blues.
Kim Ryrie.
I was into music, but I wasn't a musician. I was a frustrated musician, and therefore I need a machine that can do it for me.
And Peter Vogel.
I had no idea who Stevie Wonder was, having never listened to any pop music in my life. I've never been much of a music listener.
It's 1977, Sydney. And while Peter and Kim don't have the same taste in music, they do share a love for electrical engineering. They like working stuff out, solving problems, inventing.
Peter and I both were tinkering with electronics from the time we could walk. And I liked pulling radios apart and trying to work out what was in them.
Well, I was fascinated by electricity from age 4, I'm told, by my parents. I would find power points and stick things in to see what happened and progressed from there.
Early synthesizers were enormous. They looked a bit like an old-fashioned telephone exchange, all patch cables, knobs and dials.
I thought, well, I can't make natural sounds with this. You know, it all sounds electronic and so on, which was fine, but I really wanted to do acoustic sounds.
Inspired by synthesizer pioneers Robert Moog and Wendy Carlos's piece, Switched on Bach, Kim wanted to take things further. To be able to play a key on the keyboard, and instead of hearing an electronic recreation of a piano, it was the sound of an actual piano. So he rang his old mate Peter to give him a hand.
I said, you know, do you want to make the world's greatest synthesizer?
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
Peter left his job repairing hi-fi and camera equipment, and the pair set to work. Kim had worked on a synthesizer project before and knew that by adding a computer to control and save the settings of the synthesizer, it could change the game completely.
I was captivated by the idea that you could create music from a purely electronic source.
They built on microprocessor technology developed by Aussie inventor Tony Furse and his Quasar synths. They got their family to invest and employed engineers and programmers.
Well, we're talking about the late 70s here, so this was before home computers were a thing. So you couldn't just go down to the corner's computer shop and buy a keyboard or a monitor or a mouse. In fact, the mouse didn't exist at that time. So every bit of the system had to be handmade. And the development cost was extraordinary.
So it wasn't till about 79 that we had the first prototype. Called it the computer musical instrument, not a synthesizer, because I didn't want it confused with an analog synthesizer.
They were ready to bring their invention to the world, but there was one major problem. The price. $25,000, to be exact. In today's money, that's about $125,000.
Famously, there's many musicians now who say that they had to decide whether they were going to buy a house or whether they're going to buy a Fairlight.
So we just didn't know who was going to buy it. We didn't know anything about business, let alone marketing.
Thankfully, fellow co-founder Kim Ryrie had a next-door neighbour who, well, let's just say he knew a few people in the business.
Now, Bruce Jackson and I sort of had grown up together. Bruce had been living in America, working for a company who did the big outdoor concerts, like, what's his name, that guy? He was around for a while. Oh, that's right, Elvis. So Bruce did Elvis's sound.
When we showed this to Bruce, his jaw dropped and he said, "This is just extraordinary. I've got to introduce you to some people who would love to see this."
So what was it that made Bruce Jackson's jaw drop? To really understand the Fairlight, who used it and why, we need to break down the instrument's different functions. Let's start with those realistic instrument sounds Kim and Peter set out to make. Just how realistic were they?
Fairlight computer music instrument, disc one, sound library.
The sounds at the time would have sounded very new. They would have sounded futuristic.
Professor Samantha Bennett from the ANU School of Music is taking me through the Fairlight's library of sounds.
You've got lots of patches called horn 1, horn 2, horn M3, trump, which actually is trumpet, tubas, etc., etc. There's things like R's and there's things like choirs. There's also sounds that are entitled Peter, who I assume is doing some recordings of themselves and then including those on the discs.
So that's what it sounded like. Good enough for Elvis's sound man to make some introductions and back a synthesizer that had never left the workshop. So in 1979, Peter Vogel packed up the fragile Fairlight prototype, including the floppy discs, and flew to Los Angeles to meet a potential customer.
I was a bit worried that because he couldn't see the screen that he would have trouble. But of course, he was very adept at dealing with this sort of thing. As soon as he played some of the sounds from our library, he was hooked. He just lit up, said, OK, I'll buy it.
That first customer was Stevie Wonder.
I had no idea that he was famous.
I mean, Stevie Wonder.
And I had no idea that he was capable of writing a cheque for that amount of money.
An amazing start.
He said, "I'm going to be touring soon. I'd love to use it on the tour," which turned out to be Wembley Stadium.
I was completely chuffed because I just was a huge fan of Stevie Wonder.
Already a music legend, Stevie Wonder was impressed enough and rich enough to write a cheque for $25,000 on the spot.
And somewhere in my filing cabinet here, I have the purchase order with his fingerprint on it.
And he wasn't the only one. Peter went on a year-long tour of recording studios around the US in Bruce Jackson's tiny biplane,
which was actually given to him as a present by Elvis. And it was just big enough for him and me and the Fairlight.
Early Fairlight customers were musicians known for their experimentation with synthesizers. Herbie Hancock, Fleetwood Mac, and Peter Gabriel.
This is a modified Swanee whistle. And the rhythm of the repeat really excited me, and I've written a song around the rhythm. I was thinking of a rhythm that would go against it.
Ended up spending about a week there, sort of showing him how the thing worked. He was just like a kid in a candy shop, grinning for that whole week.
But for some 1980s musicians, the Fairlight was too realistic.
We did do some sessions where we'd ask musicians to come in and play notes, and understandably, a lot of them were quite anxious about doing it. So, for instance, especially brass players, I remember they'd come into a session and you'd ask them to just play a few notes and they'd freak out and sort of say, oh, no, I'm not doing this, I'm out of here, you know. Obviously, we didn't have the same sort of control over a classical instrument as a real brass player has, but they didn't necessarily know that.
So we've heard some of the inbuilt instruments we could use to produce our Fairlight song, but we could do with an example, a well-known track that makes use of the Fairlight's library sounds.
Probably the most well-known Fairlight sound is the Sara. It's often called the Sarah effect too, and that was named after a woman called Sarah Cohen. So it's basically her voice, and sampled and synthesized, it's quite breathy. One of the most well-known examples of the Sarah effect is on Shout by Tears for Fears. And you can hear it pretty much throughout.
Okay, so we have some sounds to play with, but we are far from it being a proper song. For that, we need to learn about another part of the Fairlight's technology.
Fairlight Computer Music Instrument, Disc 2, Page R Sequencer.
What's a music sequencer? Well, traditionally, compositions were written down on paper. That sheet music was then given to musicians to play. But the Fairlight's computer could do all that for you. The Fairlight could play itself. Co-founder Peter Vogel explains how the sequencer, named Page R, works.
The R stood for rhythm. And the idea was that Page R would be where you just put in the name of the note and how long you wanted to play it for, and then the next note and how long you wanted to play for, and then you could loop around inside that and you could play several of these at the same time and so on.
This classical sounding piece, that's all being played by the Fairlight sequencer, taken from one of the demo discs used to show it off to musicians.
Well, this was the first time that musicians could compose music without having to learn the instrument. So if someone wanted to write a piece that required a number of different instruments or an orchestral piece or something, they could sit down, write the whole thing in, and then have the machine play it for them. It was like owning their own orchestra.
Imagine sheet music that animates, moving through the bars and playing notes in real time. That's what you would have seen on the Fairlight screen. There was also a light pen, a kind of pen-shaped computer mouse. You could use this to write your notes directly onto the monitor, and you could correct or move any notes you'd played on the keyboard. Back to our Fairlight composition. We have the sounds from the library, and as we've just heard, the machine can play the instrument for us. Some drums. A little of the Sarah voice effect. Keys, and we're starting to get somewhere. Once programmed, the Fairlight was always in tune, always kept perfect musical time, and it was never late, never needed a break, and never complained. It didn't sound as good as a real band, but it did have a sort of unique quality. For record producers, always chasing the next hit, this combination was irresistible.
You have a guy playing a bass guitar. It's not necessary that he plays the bass guitar. We can do anything with sound.
You do anything with sound?
Yes, we can do anything with sound.
Yes.
That's Trevor Horn. In the 1980s, the Fairlight was the engine room of his studio. He used it for his bands Yes and Art of Noise. And when he produced records for Grace Jones, Spandau Ballet and the Pet Shop Boys.
And in fact, a lot of his compositions are actually based around the Fairlight. And if you listen to any of the records, especially coming out from Britain in the mid-80s, you can actually hear, you know, the sound. It's a bit clunky by today's standards.
Peter Wilk used to work at the Fairlight Company as an engineer. He's showing me how producers like Trevor Horn used the Fairlight sequencer.
If you knew you had a particularly, you know, fantastic drum sound or great vocal sample, you know, you could just use it again. So, for example, you could sample a vocal take. That, of course, is Holly Johnson from Frankie Goes to Hollywood. You could do some choruses like that or some ad-libs or whatever, put them in the Fairlight and then get them to trigger at the point that you needed them to sound. If you think of Frankie Goes to Hollywood, they have a very distinctive sound. It's got a rhythmic pulse.
Relax by Frankie Goes to Hollywood was a huge hit. But this is not how it sounded to begin with. It actually sounded like this. Producer Trevor Horn wasn't happy. At the 11th hour, while the band wasn't even in the studio, he used the Fairlight to completely change the song. It took care of the bass line. He used the Page R computer sequencer to trigger drum sounds and play other synthesizers he had in the studio. And the result was an 80s anthem. There's one more part of the Fairlight we need to learn about. One that could put the finishing touches on the production of our Fairlight song.
Fairlight computer music instrument, disc 3, sampler.
Remember that second of Stravinsky that we heard earlier, the Orc 2? That was one of the first samples ever taken from another record, and it came as standard with every Fairlight sound library. It was created using the Fairlight's inbuilt digital sampler, the first of its kind. Anywhere. Why is this important? Take this track from James Brown, Funky Drummer. That drum hook has been sampled 1,700 times. That means it's on 1,700 different records. And that's just one sample. James Brown's back catalogue has been sampled more than 14,000 times and counting. 1,700. Making him the most sampled artist of all time. The Fairlight may not have been the digital sampler that was used on all those records, but it was the first one ever created.
The lineage of those sounds can be traced back to the Fairlight CMI. When we're producing music today, we're using samples to build or to compose a song all the time. So, for example, The Art of Noise, in Close to the Edit, there is a small sample of a girl just singing, "Hey." And that sample was used by The Prodigy's Firestarter.
Almost every hip-hop record ever made uses sampling.
Can I kick it? Can I kick it? Can I kick it?
So it's not about that if the Fairlight didn't exist, it would have made the 80s sound different. It would have made all of contemporary electronic music sound different, potentially non-existent.
But the Fairlight's inventors never intended for the instrument's sampling capability to forever alter the music industry.
We weren't imagining that you would sample someone else's recording. That was just, it actually never occurred to us.
Kim Ryrie.
We thought that people would just come up with their own sounds, you know, they'd sample natural instruments but then mess around with those sounds and stuff. So we were sort of thinking more like that. I struggled with it a bit. I didn't think it was good to be doing that, but it was happening regardless of the Fairlight. And it's why Peter and I sort of thought it was cheating. I mean, if I was making an album and I heard bits of my album being played as samples on other people's music, I don't know how I'd feel about that. Probably not all that great.
Peter Vogel.
We also had no second thoughts as to taking samples off other people's records to use in our library. At that time, it just wasn't a thing because sampling hadn't existed before. No one had turned their minds as to who might own the copyright in a quarter of a second sample out of a whole album. But it certainly became the whole phenomenon of sampling that we know in this century. We had our customers sending us sounds that they'd sampled, and we included them in the sound library as well. It was pretty much anything that sounded interesting, we threw it in there.
This is the way
we thin the
size.
People like Peter Gabriel, he would go out recording sounds in junkyards, smashing TV screens and things like that.
TV smash. Take one. One, two, three, four. I think we did it.
And he would just let us have those samples. He would just give us his own sound library and let us distribute it to all our users.
Fairlight engineer Peter Wilk steps us through how the sampler works.
You could literally just stick a microphone to the back and, you know, say, it'd immediately come back on the keyboard. And you could play that polyphonically. You know, within, you know, like 1 minute, you could see the capabilities of the sampling. Latterly, you know, especially when the later model came out in 1985, where one could sample for much longer, people then started to use them in different ways. By that time, one could actually sample in, say, a whole line or a whole breakbeat or, you know, like a whole vocal line that might be 30 seconds long. Kim and Peter, they actually thought this was cheating. And yet it became arguably the sort of like the biggest seller of the entire system.
Some of the first recordings that were made with the Fairlight were of artists breaking things and smashing stuff up. A classic example of one of those is the great glass smash that's about 2 minutes in on Kate Bush's Babushka.
So far, we've built in the drums, main chords, and a keyboard melody into our Fairlight track. Now let's use the Fairlight sampler to add in some vocal elements. Here's a choir on backing vocals, and this vocal sample adds some rhythm. We're not quite off to the Grammys yet, but not bad for a 40-year-old synthesizer. And we'll put our track to use in a minute. As the 80s went on, music made using the Fairlight was everywhere.
It soundtracked a generation of music.
If you were in the UK or Europe, if you were in Australia, or if you were in the United States in the 80s, she would have turned on mainstream radio and heard The Fairlight within 5 minutes.
But later models were as much as $100,000. So if you'd forked out all that money for your Fairlight, you had to sell a lot of records to pay it off.
Combined record sales of albums that featured the Fairlight CMI would run into the hundreds of millions.
It wasn't the only synth out there. The Fairlight did have its rivals, but none came close to having the same capability or the same influence.
I can't really imagine what commercial anglophone music would have sounded like without it. And it's not just because of the instrument itself, it's because of its legacy and the sheer impact it had.
So with all this success, Kim and Peter must have been having a great time, lapping up all that fame and all that fortune.
No, really never, because it was always just such a drama trying to keep things going. it sounds like fun, and it was fun, but it was also pretty stressful for Peter and I. You know, you've got 100 mouths to feed every month. And in those days, there was no internet. So if we've got to get a new software release to a guy over on tour somewhere, for instance, Jean-Michel Jarre bought one, we would be using a modem on a telephone transmitting at 9,600 bits per second. So it would take hours, and if it dropped out at any point, which was very likely to happen, you had to start again. It was like an absolute nightmare.
And by the late 1980s, larger manufacturers had caught up to the Fairlight.
You had Emu's Emulator, the Emulator 2. Yamaha had released their DX7. The new Korgs were coming out. These all contained amazing-sounding pre-programmed samples at a tenth of the price of a Fairlight CMI. And so it put the Fairlight out of business very quickly, almost as quickly as it came into business.
And the financial landscape changed too.
That's what, you know, caused the problem when the recession hit in 88, because we just didn't have, emergency funds to carry us through that. Peter and I were both, neither of us were that interested in making money. It was just never on the agenda, which is really a bad thing if you're trying to run a business.
After the 88 recession, Kim restarted the company as Fairlight ESP, Electric Sound and Picture. He had success well into the 90s, catering for TV and film post-production. In 2009, Peter Vogel developed and released a 30th anniversary edition of the Fairlight called the 30A. But the project got tangled in a copyright case and only one was ever made.
I think the fact that not many people know about the Fairlight and not know of its existence is a reflection on how the Fairlight was prohibitively expensive. And so that confined its use to very few, very wealthy, very commercially successful recording artists. And so it's not really surprising that the Fairlight isn't a household name.
But the original Fairlight instrument is making a comeback.
They are so popular, they literally fly out the door. And in fact, I only half-jokingly say I could sell one of them every week.
Today, Peter Wilk restores Fairlights and sells them to people all over the world.
I've always seen how wonderful these machines are and how loved they are. And so there's always a fondness there. The Fairlight's on a journey. You know, it's come this far. Some of them are 40 years old now, and hopefully after being restored, you know, they'll have another few decades of life.
Peter and Kim were never driven by fame or that fussed by fortune. Their fascination was with the technology, the engineering. That's what made them dismantle clocks and radios as kids, and it's what brought them together to create the Fairlight. Here seems like a good spot to put our song in. So how do they feel about what they achieved? What do they see as their legacy?
My neighbour here came over one day with a Peter Gabriel album in his hand, and he said, "Hey Peter, you've been involved in electronic music, haven't you?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, here's a coincidence. There's some guy another guy called Peter Vogel, who's got a credit on this record. And I just said, oh, that is a coincidence, isn't it? So I think that it left its fingerprint on the musical history of the 80s that may not have happened if it weren't for us. But I'll leave that to others to judge.
I really wish every time someone went to play on a keyboard, they'd say, oh, I'm just going to go and play on the Fairlight, like you call a Hoover a vacuum cleaner. Yeah, no, I don't think we're quite up there.
As far as the world is concerned, we're no Steve Jobs or Bill Gates, that's for sure. That's because wealth is a very important part of success in most people's eyes, and that's the bit we didn't quite get right.
The Fairlight CMI, the sound you've never heard of, was produced by James Viver. The supervising producer was Michelle Rayner. Sound design and original music was also created by James using, yep, you guessed it, the Fairlight CMI app. The sound engineer today was John Jacobs. And a huge congratulations to the production team for winning the audio music category in this year's prestigious International Pre-Italia competition.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.